From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. An unwed mother in Utah can give up her baby for adoption within a day after its birth. But what if the baby's birth father wants to retain his parental rights? Some say current Utah law makes it too easy to cut birth fathers out of the decision-making process, and they want to give birth fathers more time and more notice. Others say changes to the law would just delay adoptions to loving families and violate the mother's privacy rights. Utah lawmakers have recently heard emotional testimony from both points of view, and today on the program, we're exploring the complicated balancing act between parental rights and child welfare. Plus, the continued uptick in affinity fraud and how to protect yourself from scam artists. All that and your calls after the news. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. There are no easy answers when it comes to an accidental pregnancy to an unmarried couple. Is adoption always the best option? What if the birth mother wants to keep the pregnancy quiet? How much say should the birth father have in the outcome? Utah legislators have been grappling with these weighty issues as they consider a couple of bills that would give birth fathers more notice of a pending adoption and more time to decide if they want to be an active parent. Today on the program, we're talking about the rights of birth fathers and balancing those with the rights of birth mothers and the rights of the child. Joining me in studio this hour, Wes Hutchins. He's an attorney and the founder of the Hutchins Law Firm, where he specializes in adoption, personal injury, and arbitration. He serves as the chairman of the advisory board for the Adoption Exchange here in Utah, and he is the current president of the Utah Adoption Council. And Wes Hutchins, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you, Jennifer. Good to be here.
Also with us, David Hardy, an attorney with Curtin and McConkie. He's a fellow of the American Academy of Adoption Attorneys and is the past president of the Utah Adoption Council, and he joins me in studio as well. David Hardy, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Jennifer.
Later on in the program, we are talking about scams and Mormons using religious connections to commit fraud. But first, father's rights. If you're a birth mother, a birth father, or an adoptive family, what do you think about changing Utah's adoption law to give biological fathers more say? 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Gentlemen, before we get to the nuts and bolts of the two bills that are floating their way through the legislative process, I want to start with a recent case, the Manzanares case. Just to bring listeners up to speed, Rob Manzanares is a man from Colorado. He fathered a child with a woman, Carrie Terry, who's also a Coloradan. When he found out she was pregnant, he filed a paternity petition in Colorado, but then Terry came to Utah to have the baby and gave it up for adoption. And because Manzanares didn't file with the state of Utah, he gave up his parental rights here, as I understand it. Is that a fair summation of what's happened?
I think it is. It's a very weighty decision in terms of its weight alone. It's it's 73 page opinion, which is very unusual for the Utah Supreme Court, but I think you've summarized it very well.
And the Utah Supreme Court recently ruled in Manzanares' favor. Explain what the court's decision was. Wes Hutchins.
Well, basically, and it is a very lengthy opinion, and approximately half of those 73 pages are written by the minority, two justices, so it's a 3-2 decision. But there seems to be unanimity on a few issues, and that is, for example, that birth mothers are not going to be able to misrepresent their intentions as they possibly were able to do before. And by that I mean they're not going to be able to state, well, I'm going to Utah for a short visit, in this case, to visit my sick father, and then I'll be back to Colorado and we'll talk later. And it's very clear in the case, and in fact, two justices referenced Ms. Terry's conduct as both fraudulent and outrageous, and the decision stands for the proposition that we're not going to let people hide behind the fraud immunity statute and permit them to trigger a qualifying circumstance in Utah that mandates the birth fathers come to Utah and do all the things that they're required to do here, especially in this case where Mr. Manzanares did everything he needed to in Colorado to protect his rights.
What's your take on the Manzanares case, David
well,
Hardy?
First of all, in the interest of full disclosure, I am counsel of record for Kerry, and so I disclose that. And then a couple of my partners have been representing the adoptive couple as well. So I come at this with a view of in the position of advocate as well. So I'm a little bit biased here. As I view the Manzanares case, I think the key here, it addresses rights of out-of-state fathers, and especially a requirement in the Utah Code dealing with whether they know if a mother is in the state of Utah. The district court here looked at the situation, determined that, and under its finding, that Mr. Manzanares knew that the mother was in Utah, that he would be bound by Utah law. The Supreme Court looked at it and said, looking at all the circumstances, determined that there probably was not enough evidence. In fact, they determined that there wasn't enough evidence of his knowledge. Therefore, he would not be bound by some of the requirements we have in Utah law. Instead, we would look to Colorado to see if he acted to protect his rights.
So in general, you would say that this is a very narrow decision to this one case. It doesn't have widespread implications for out-of-state fathers in the state of Utah?
Not necessarily. I think it does have some real implications as far as other fathers whose children may be placed for adoption in Utah, if they're out-of-state fathers. Adoption agencies, adoptive parents, those involved in the process, if they're going to rely upon Utah law, what they're going to need to do is to make sure that the father knows of the mother being in Utah, whether by letter or notice, something very clear that she is here in order to rely on, for example, the Utah Putative Father Registry. Now, I may be jumping ahead of things here, but that's one of the things that the district court looked at, is whether the Putative Father Registry could be used. I think if you want to utilize the Putative Father Registry, you've got to look at Manzanares and say, if you're going to rely on it, it's got to be very clear that he knows she's in Utah.
Mm-hmm. Wes Hutchins.
Yes, I think one of the very interesting aspects of the Manzanares case is this debate over belief versus knowledge. And in Manzanares, they said, look, a birth father's potential belief that something may be happening in Utah is no longer going to be enough to trigger that birth father's obligation to come to Utah, file his paternity action, file his affidavit in support of his paternity action, and file his notice of commencement with the Utah Putative Father Registry, which up until now he's had to do all of those things. And so it stands for the proposition that you have to have knowledge, or he has to have knowledge that he could have obtained through the exercise of reasonable diligence. And so the interesting thing about Manzanares is typically when a case is overturned, it's sent back down to the trial court level for additional findings of fact to be entered. In this case, the Utah Supreme Court said, we're not even going to do that. We have enough evidence on the record to show that he did not have knowledge. He had potentially a belief, but that was not enough.
So this can be a very complicated case, but I think it illustrates some of what's going on in current Utah law. So just briefly describe for us, Wes Hutchins, what does a birth father have to do to establish paternity and to say, I want to be an active parent. I don't want this child to go up for adoption.
Well, that's been a very difficult question, Jennifer, for a lot of out-of-state birth fathers in particular, and even in-state birth fathers in the past. Difficult from the standpoint of trying to wade through our statutes, find the necessary forms, and to do so strictly and fully and in a timely manner. That's been one of the major complaints among birth fathers in state and out of state. But the requirements, to answer your question, are that a birth father must file a paternity action that has certain information contained in it. In support of that paternity action, he must file an affidavit in support of his paternity action, which includes a child care plan. It must include language that says he's willing to abide by any court order requiring him to pay child support and various other things. The third thing is that he has to file a notice of commencement with Utah's Putative Father Registry. All of these things have to be done, and this is where it gets a little confusing. All of these things have to be done before the later of 20 days after he becomes aware of a qualifying circumstance, or the birth mother places the child or relinquishes her rights or consents to an adoption.
David Hardy, on the current situation in Utah law, do you feel like the law is working?
My feeling is yes, the law is working. There are complaints from time to time that the process is difficult. Wes has referred to the fact that some fathers have found it difficult, but there are plenty of fathers who have complied with it. I think generally it is working. We may want to go, if you want, we can go into some of the history of where the law came from. But as far as the right of a father, what he needs to do, I think it's consistent with that right. And for the most part, it works very well.
Is the Manzanares case an outlier? I mean, how does it fit in the scope of things? Are there so many cases that are like Manzanares that we're seeing? Are we seeing an increasing trend when it comes to birth father claims? Or are these still kind of isolated cases?
No, I would consider it an outlier. There have been a few cases like Manzanares involving out-of-state fathers. They tend to draw a little bit more attention than most adoptions. I don't think there's been an increase in the number of cases. And so as far as the facts in it, I think it is an outlier.
Wes Hutchins.
I would respectfully disagree with that, with all due respect to my brother-in-law here, Mr. Hardy. What you have to look at is the nature of these litigations that come all the way up to our appellate court system. In fact, as KSL ran this last Friday, Mr. Manzanares indicated he's paid $170,000 for his fight. Most unmarried biological fathers cannot afford the legal battle that ensues when their rights have been violated. They can't find pro bono attorneys to represent them, and they can't come up with the money to pursue their rights. And so I think the truth of the matter is that these cases are representative of a much larger group of biological fathers that do not have the option to pursue their rights. And when they find out what's involved, they just go away.
Wes Hutchins is an attorney and founder of the Hutchins Law Firm. He is in favor of changing Utah law when it comes to fathers' rights. Also with us, David Hardy, an attorney with Curtin & McConkie. He thinks status quo works just fine. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Let's go to the phones. And Christopher is joining us from Williamsport, Pennsylvania. Christopher, hi.
Yes, how you doing, man? Can you hear me okay?
Yep, go right ahead.
Perfect. With all due respect to Mr. Hardy, I understand where he's coming from, but the exact same bill that they're trying to put up there, I agree perfectly, because everything that's happened with the Manzanares case and everything has happened to myself. And I've seen the extremities of what some of these adoption centers and the birth mothers will go through to keep the father in the dark. My daughter's mother, she went as far as telling me that the child died. She went as far as telling me that the child was an opposite sex of what it was. I live about a half hour away from the Poconos, and I'm very far from Utah. I work for the Department of Defense, and it happened to somebody as such as I, as far as I am from Utah. I do not understand some of Utah laws, and how could I possibly have known that she had took the child to Utah? I spoke to congressmen, senators, state representatives, attorney generals, FBI, even the Department of Defense, who I work for, to try to reverse or undo what she had done. And nobody in my state or Commonwealth of Pennsylvania could help me. It took me to take her to court twice to find out that my child was even alive. It took me to take her to court twice and file her papers to find out that my child was even in Utah. But under Utah laws, under Utah laws, say that I have 30 days from the day that I found out that the child is put up for adoption to start putting in paperwork or filing paperwork. And that is almost impossible. Last time I checked, I'm named after Jesus. I am not him. I cannot know certain things. Of all the places she took my child, Utah was not on the top of my list of where she could have possibly have taken my child.
So, Christopher, I guess your story illustrates a couple, brings to mind a couple of questions. So, first, how involved were you with the woman during her pregnancy? Did you support her in the prenatal care and all of that?
Ma'am, I didn't put up a good $10,000 while I was with her. I bought her a car. I paid for a house. I went to doctor's appointments with her. I gave her money. I took care of her other two children, as such as if they were my own. So I was very involved all the way to the point where she disappeared in May of 2010. And I called everybody under the sun trying to find her. And she wouldn't, nobody could help me in my own state. It wasn't until she got in touch with a couple of mutual friends of ours and let them know that, that she had given birth. She didn't tell me this.
So, Christopher, I guess the other question is, would you have wanted claim on this child? Would you have been willing to support this child for the rest of its life?
Yes, I love my children. I even care and love for the child that is the one that's in Utah or wherever it is up in that got put up for adoption. I broke a promise to my oldest child about even going to Iraq again. Yes, I'm a five-time Iraq veteran. I told my daughters I would never go again, but I had to go back in order to ascertain enough funds so I can fight in Utah and to try to get my child. Now, if that doesn't show love, then I don't know what will. I got shot again while I was over there. But, again, I done that just so I can try to get to know my child or want to take care of my child.
Christopher, thanks for the story and for your service to our country. And Wes Hutchins, I suppose that Christopher's story and experience exemplify some of the issues that you have with current Utah law.
Yes, it does. And to follow Mr. Hardy's lead, in the interest of full disclosure, Christopher is a client of mine, and he is representative of many other birth fathers who have spoken out and those that remain silent for a variety of different reasons. And it repeats over and over, time and time again, Jennifer, the tragedy that these engaged, committed, loving birth fathers want to have in the raising of their children. They're not all deadbeat dads. They're not all child abusers or women batterers or abusive to the mothers of their children. They want to be involved and are devoted.
David Hardy, just very quickly, your response to what Christopher had to say.
Yeah, I can't speak to the specifics of his case, not knowing the background, but I would note that as we look at fathers and their rights and what they have done, and as I understood him to say, he had no idea she was in Utah. If a father is not aware of a mother having come to Utah or placing the child for adoption under Utah law, what the Utah courts will do is look to the actions that they have taken in their home state, what actions they have taken to assert parental rights. And so, not being able to judge here, I'm not sure exactly what he was done, but the law does specifically recognize if he's not aware, we're going to look and see what he did do to assert parental rights.
So you think there is an avenue for remedy. We need to take a break. We're talking with David Hardy, an attorney with Curtin McConkie, Wes Hutchins with the Hutchins Law Firm. We're talking about fathers' rights and a couple of bills that are percolating their way through Utah's legislative process. If you have questions or comments about Utah adoption law, feel free to call us. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. What legal rights do birth fathers have in Utah? A couple of bills working their way through the Utah legislature would tweak current adoption law, giving unwed fathers more time to protect their rights. But opponents say the change could dissuade unwed mothers from choosing adoption. If you have questions or comments about Utah adoption law or experience as a birth father or who wanted to assert his parental rights, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. With us this hour, David Hardy, an attorney with Curtin and McConkie, and Wes Hutchins, founder of the Hutchins Law Firm. And let's go back to the phones, and Monica's been waiting from Weber County. Monica, hi.
Hi, Jennifer. This is Monica from Weber County.
Hi.
Hi, I am a birth mother. I have a couple of questions on this bill. First of all, I'd like to say oppose this bill. What I would like to know is, how do you consider protecting the birth mother's privacy through all of this?
Okay, that's a good question.
This is a question for Wes.
Wes Hutchins.
Well, it's an excellent question, and as our legislature has pointed out with its legislative intent, these types of laws require a balancing of the birth mother's privacy interest with the rights of the birth father's right to parent a child when he timely exercises those rights. Our statutes, our case law, even the standards that adoption agencies are supposed to follow in Utah, as well as experience, all four of those things tell us that privacy alone does not trump the rights of a biological father. As soon as the woman decides to carry that child to term, the biological father has various rights.
Okay.
David Hardy.
I think what Monica is referring to is 308 and a requirement of notice. One of the reasons I oppose 308, one of the reasons the Utah Adoption Council opposes 308, is because it impinges upon the mother's right to privacy. A birth mother has an established right to privacy. Wes is correct when he says that the father can't assert rights. Sometimes we refer to it legally as an inchoate right that he has. But he has a right, but the mother has a right to privacy, and to require and notice impinges on that right, and so that's a problem with 308. I think Monica's concern is legitimate.
Mm-hmm. Monica, if you had to advertise in the newspaper that to let a birth father know that you were expecting, would that have somehow changed the outcome in your case?
You know, in my case, I was very lucky to have such a positive adoption. But in the case of other women who may be in abusive situations where they feel like the father is not in a place where he can raise a child, I can really see that or abortion.
Okay. Monica, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome.
801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. We'll go to Dorian, who's calling from Provo. Dorian, welcome.
Hello?
Dorian, hi, are you there?
Yes.
Great. Go right ahead.
My question really is for Dave Hardy. From what I understand, the Utah law, it allows for fraud on the part of the mother. And if the mother, say, commits fraud and tells the father, no, I'm not going to give it up for adoption, then actually has the baby without the father's knowledge and then gives it up for adoption, then the father has no rights. To me, that's fraud. I just want to understand, or maybe you can tell me the state of Utah's position on how they would uphold that, even though there was fraud involved.
Okay. Dorian, thanks for the call. Is that the definition of fraud? If a mother says one thing and acts in a different way, and it affects the outcome for the birth father, is that fraud? David Hardy.
It may depend on the situation as to whether or not it is fraud. Generally, a statement of future intention is not going to be a fraudulent statement. It's and I'm getting into some legal terminology, but it's a promissory statement. Fraud is a statement regarding a presently existing material fact. So, for example, it would be or could be fraud on the part of a birth mother if she were to say she had miscarried and was no longer carrying a child. That could be taken as a fraudulent statement if the father relied on it. The way the Utah statute is framed, though, and some have said that it condones fraud, but the way it's framed is that a father is not entitled to justify his failure to comply with the requirements of the statute by claiming fraud. What the Utah statute says is that every individual is responsible for their own actions, and the father cannot justify his failure to act based upon statements made by the birth mother. Something that's in there, you know, you could still pursue a civil claim for fraud, but it's there to allow for the permanency of adoptive placements.
Dorian, what I hear you saying is that you feel like there may be a loophole that needs to be closed in Utah adoption law?
Right. And my question then is, if that is the case, and I've read some cases where that has been the case, what when that child, you know, I think that when the child is put for adoption, the premise is, and the adoptive parents are probably going to tell him, well, you know, I don't know a better way to say this, but your birth mother and father, they couldn't take care of you, or they didn't want to take care of you, they didn't want you. I guess that's not the right terminology, but what are you going to tell that child when he gets older and he finds out that, you know what, you were placed for adoption because your mother lied to your father. Your father wanted you, but we just, you know, he didn't have a position because of the Utah law. I mean, I don't understand it. It seems like the birth or the adopted parents have been perpetuating a lie at that point. I don't see how the child is going to look at the birth parents or the adoptive parents the same way. Like, you've been lying to me this whole time.
Dorian, thanks very much for the call. David Hardy, I'd like to just hear your thoughts on that. Do you feel like the current law is protective enough?
I think the current law is appropriate. And with respect to Dorian's concern about what the parents are going to tell the child, the adoptive parents are going to tell the child, all adoptive parents are different. But in my experience, adoptive parents are open and honest about the background and will share that when the child reaches an appropriate age. And so if the father has opposed, they generally, and like I say, all adoptive parents are different, they're not going to say he was a bad guy or that he didn't want the child. They will probably phrase it in terms, and this is what I've usually heard it said, they will probably phrase it in terms of your mother loved you enough to know that adoption was good. Your father opposed it, but we're glad to have you, and you know, we'll be open that the fact that he opposed, that he wanted the child, but the mother had made the judgment, and the adoption was appropriate based on the law.
Mm-hmm. Wes Hutchins said.
Yes, thank you, Jennifer. I respectfully disagree with Dave. Once again, no surprise there, I suppose. But the definition of fraud in Utah is much broader than what Dave has indicated. You can have affirmative misstatements of fact, but there's a whole body of case law on this issue. You can have omissions of material fact that constitute fraud. And by that, what I mean is if you have a duty to disclose something and you remain silent about it, and the party who relies on that omission or that deception is injured because of it or experienced damages, the loss of a child, parenting a child, then that is classic fraud as well. It just defies logic. It defies fundamental fairness. It defies constitutionally guaranteed rights to suggest that we're going to legalize adoption. We're going to legalize fraud in this state. Yes, what it means is you cannot come back and challenge an adoptive placement if there's been fraud. And the statute, 78B6106, actually is inviting lawsuits against birth mothers and those that may be complicit in fraud and seeking money damages against them. So I predict in the future we're going to see many lawsuits coming out of these cases where fraud is involved, much like we have in the John Wyatt Baby Emma case out of the Eastern District of Virginia Federal District Court.
Some people who say, you know, changing Utah law right now, it's a very delicate balance between the rights of the mother, the rights of the birth father, what's best for this child. Why put more hurdles in the way of adoptive families? I mean, it seems like one more thing that they have to go through. Why do you think that is an acceptable outcome, Wes Hutchins?
The hurdles that you're suggesting, Jennifer, are merely constitutionally guaranteed rights that we all have to be involved with rearing our offspring. The Lehr decision by the United States Supreme Court talks about if a birth father is present and accounted for and grasps the opportunity to be involved in rearing that child, that is a constitutionally protected right. Due process basically means we need to have fair notice and an opportunity to be heard. The current structure of the law in Utah does not provide those things.
Okay, fair notice under the current structure. David Hardy, so what's wrong with giving, requiring notice for an unwed birth father? What's wrong with sending them a letter and just letting them know that, hey, this is happening?
Well, the simple answer is it's bad for children. And the reason that is because By requiring a notice, what you're doing is you're causing problems with the permanency and security of adoptive placements. It presents a reasons for undoing. One of the values of our code is permanence and stability in adoptive placements. If you are requiring a notice, there's always the potential that a notice not properly given, based on whatever reason, is going to result in an adoption being disrupted. A child being taken from a home where they have lived and grown up and been raised.
Because some of these cases go on 3-4 years.
Oh,
at least
longer than that. I've been involved with some that have gone on 7-8 years and then even continue after that with some kind of relationship. So the problem with a notice is that it creates a sense of instability. There are some uncertainties there. I would note in response to Wes's comment that there are constitutional issues here. Our Utah statutes, as they presently are, have been reviewed by our courts repeatedly, and they have consistently found to be constitutional and consistent with constitutional principles.
You look like you're chomping at the bit. Wes Hutchins.
Well, I would say that there are several cases in Utah where our court has found that the full and strict compliance requirement of birth fathers is waived in order to protect those fundamental constitutional rights. What Mr. Hardy is referring to is that the statute in and of itself is facially constitutional, but our statute expressly states that the rights of all parties affected by an adoption proceeding must be considered and balanced in determining what constitutional protections and processes are necessary and appropriate. That's quoting right out of 78B6102. And so to suggest that privacy, stability, and finality are to be considered in a vacuum absent these rights of birth fathers is misleading.
Our time is very short. I'd like to get each of you to respond to this final question. I think it's a fact that more people are deciding not to get married and to have children together, and that will probably, if the current trajectory stands, that will become more culturally acceptable. Do you think this is just a natural response to what society is already doing, that fathers want to be more involved in their children? Is change to the current law inevitable? Wes Hutchins?
Yes, it's absolutely inevitable. I think we're finally realizing that the archaic notions that those that have children out of wedlock somehow have their rights eroded is no longer in play. The fact is that people are going to have sexual relations outside the bonds of marriage. That does not mean that biological fathers, because they have not been able to marry the biological mothers, have any less rights than the biological mothers do.
David Hardy, is change inevitable, or do you think that the current law as it stands is something that should hold?
Well, I think the current law should hold. I think the societal changes certainly have a role in the discussion that we're having here.
Although, archaic?
Well, I don't think they're archaic, but I know that there are some that do. I note that last week, Representative Watkins at the
hearing. She's the sponsor of House Bill 308.
She's the sponsor of House Bill 308. As things were concluding, she wished that she could wave her magic wand and that nobody would have children until they were married, which I think is a nice goal, but certainly in our society community right now, that's not the case. Nevertheless, I think the way our code is appropriate, because a father needs to assert his rights. There needs to be something solid there so what we can determine what's going to happen with these children. Marriage is one way that the father has asserted his rights, the child coming forth within a marriage. If the child does not come forth within a marriage, which happens frequently, the father needs to take the steps to assert his rights. We have far too many fathers who fail to do that. Now, do they have rights? Should they be balanced? Yes, they should. But I think the Utah Adoption Code is looking out for the children, looking out for them and what they need, and strikes the appropriate balance.
David Hardy, an attorney with Curtin and McConkie, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Also, Wes Hutchins, attorney with the Hutchins Law Firm. And Wes, thanks to you.
Thank you, Jennifer.
More discussion on this topic coming up as we go throughout the legislative session. Up next on this program, steering clear of affinity fraud. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. With estimates of fraud in Utah hitting the $2 billion mark, a high-ranking official of the LDS Church is speaking out at this year's Fraud College. It's an effort to educate the public against scams. And joining me now to talk about affinity fraud and the role religious connections can play in financial schemes is Brent Baker. He is the founder and director of the Fraud College Conference. We'll give you details on that happening later in the program. He's also an attorney with Clyde Snow. And Brent Baker, thanks very much for your time today.
Nice to be here, Jennifer.
Also with us, Mark Zimbelman, an accounting professor at BYU, and he's received 4 different fellowship awards, has served on the editorial board of the Accounting Review. And Professor, thanks very much for your time today.
It's good to be here.
If you know someone who's been scammed by a ward member or a fellow parishioner, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Brent Baker, I want to start with you. The FBI has labeled Salt Lake City as one of the top 5 places for fraud. And give us a sense of the extent of the problem here in this state.
Well, I'll give you, I just spoke with a special agent at the FBI in the last week who said that the fraud number, again, is in excess of $2 billion this year. The one year I looked at recently was the year 2010. And the year 2010 is when they got very serious about compiling that statistic or that number for Utah. And the number then was $1.4 billion. Well, to put it in perspective, I went to the Utah Ski Association website to find out the amount of revenue the state brings in from its prestigious ski industry. The number is surprising. So $1.4 billion in fraud losses, the ski industry brings in $1.2 billion. So essentially, in this state, we are netting out our ski industry with fraud.
Not a good sign. Mark Zimbelman, define what affinity fraud is for us. It's groups of people who have common interests. Is it just churches?
No, it can be all sorts of organizations. There's been affinity fraud in cultural groups, Haitians. In Florida a few years ago, were subject to a large affinity fraud that the SEC prosecuted. So whenever there's a group of people that have a common bond, they end up trusting each other. People come in that have a propensity for fraud and take advantage of that trust.
I'm thinking of huge fraud schemes, Bernie Madoff, other Christian sects have seen this. There's a piece in the current issue of The Economist that says affinity fraud is really a global problem. But why are religious groups so vulnerable? Mark Zimbelman?
I think the main reason is because of the trust factor. When you're in a religious group and you see people that have your common beliefs, you believe that you're living a righteous life, so to speak, and you end up trusting them, especially if they become leaders in the organization, or a leader has some association with the fraud perpetrator and can, you know, recommend him or her. That trust is easily passed on.
Are there particular issues with the Mormon dynamic here? About 60% of Utah's population belongs to the LDS Church. How is fraud happening in wards and stakes here locally? Brent Baker.
Well, I think that we here in Utah, as Professor Zimbelman said, this isn't a problem that's specific to the LDS Church, nor is it specific to religion in general. But in Utah, we do have the perfect petri dish. We have all the right ingredients to grow this fraud bacteria. We have a very trusting community. We have basic tenet in, frankly, Christianity in general is that and Mark Zimmelman alluded to this as well, and that is, if you are righteous, you will be blessed with riches. The scriptures are replete with references to that. What they don't understand is those riches may not be monetary riches. Mm. And that goes way back to the reformers at the end of the Dark Ages. So you've got the trust in community, these basic religious tenets, and then you've got this constantly refreshing workforce, and that is the LDS missionaries who are returning each week from doing 2 years of voluntary, Christian humanitarian service. And in this economy, it's tough to get a job. And so oftentimes they're being recruited either inadvertently or knowingly into being participants in these schemes.
Mm-hmm. Brent Baker, he is the founder and director of the Fraud College Conference that is happening this Thursday. We'll give you more details on that in a bit. Also with us, Mark Zimbelman, a professor of accounting at BYU, and we're talking about affinity fraud, particularly here in the state of Utah. If you have been a victim or if you've seen someone who has been, give us a call. Tell us your story, 801-355-8255. Or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Back to the fraud that's being perpetuated here through these networks, religious networks, or whatever kind of network. Who are the victims that we're seeing here in the state of Utah? Mark Zimbelman?
Well, a lot of times the victims are members of the church, and it's not just Utah, it's outside of Utah. Victims of affinity fraud are members of the organization that the affinity is represented by. So it might be ward members, it might be stake members, it may be people throughout the state who had heard about the investment opportunity, so to speak.
Is it young? Is it old? Is it men? Is it women?
Well, yeah, I think it's spread around. I don't know if I have a good demographic for you, but there's definitely some of the older population, retired. I've had people come up to me at the last fraud college and tell me their story. It was a retired couple who basically put all their retirement savings into an investment, and it turned out to be a fraud, and they lost everything. So it's tragic when it happens. The fraud perpetrators do leave a lot of pain and suffering in their wake, so to speak.
Brent Baker, older people particularly susceptible, or can it be any of us who are duped into a get-rich scheme?
It can be any of us. I think the reason it seems especially apparent in the older population is because those people have their nest egg, their savings already accumulated. But I've seen schemes involving people who were preying on students and their student loan proceeds. I've seen professional athletes targeted. I think I saw this morning I saw a headline that involved a large synagogue in the southeast somewhere. So it really cuts across the full spectrum.
Does it say it's something about us, though, as investors? Are we just naive? Are we desperate for money? Is this tied to our economic recession, Mark Zimbelman?
I think there is definitely some naivety. Brent and I was just talking, one of the true tests is whether the investment meets common sense rules of risk and reward. A tenet in finance is that if you have a high return, you have high risk. And so most of the time, these fraud schemes, these investment opportunities, promise high risk or high return with low risk. And that can be 20%, 30%, or higher. It can be 800%. There's all sorts of them. But anytime you get about, in the teens in this economy, you have to have a lot of risk. Mm. And if they're promising, no, steady guaranteed returns at 12-15% or 20%, I would be very, very skeptical of it. And anything above that, I would just flat out say it's got to be a Ponzi scheme, pretty much. One other thought, you asked who the victims are. Interestingly, a lot of times victims are also include professionals such as dentists and doctors and so forth who may not, they have a lot of disposable income, they want to make investments, they know they need to invest their money, but they don't perhaps have a lot of savvy in terms of investments. They don't understand risk and return, I suppose, or maybe they just trust others too much and to invest their money with them.
Mark Zimbelman, he's an accounting professor at Brigham Young University, also with us Brent Baker, a securities attorney and an organizer of the Fraud College. Brent Baker, you've been operating this Fraud College as a way to educate the public for a couple of years now. This is the first year that a high-ranking official from the LDS Church will be participating. Why do you think he's coming now?
That's a good question, because it's not as if the LDS Church has been sitting sort of sheepishly by and not doing anything. They certainly have been telling their congregations for a long time that they needed to be wise in making investment decisions, and they needed to be honest in their business dealings. And I even recall a letter that was read over the pulpit a couple of years ago. But for those of us who practice in this area, we see that the affinity frauds are not slowing down. I don't think they're cyclical. I don't think they're related to the ebbs and flows of the economy. And it's time. And to its credit, the LDS Church contacted me this time and said, we want to have a stronger participation. It's not as if I were pestering them. So I think they finally realized, with most major issues, that now's the time.
Michael Otterson, who is the managing director of public affairs for the LDS Church, will be speaking later this week at your conference. What's he going to say, Brent Baker?
Well, I can tell you what I hope he's going to say. I hope he's going to tell the community that these types of white-collar frauds, these type of affinity frauds in particular, are not just a very serious violation of the law, which can result in you know, very serious sanctions, including loss of your liberty, jail time. But he's also hopefully going to say that they are also a sin that might require very serious steps towards repentance. So those two things I hope he's going to say at least.
One of the candidates for Utah Attorney General, Sean Reyes, wants to set up a fraud registry similar to a sex offender registry. Mark Zimbelman, would that work? Do you think that would keep people at least aware of who is out there, who has been convicted of a fraud scheme?
I think it's a great idea, to be honest with you. I'd love to see that sort of thing be put together, and so that people can be aware of the background of individuals who are perpetrating a fraud. And a lot of times these are repeat offenders. They've done it before, and they'll come into a new community and do it again. And I like the idea. I don't know what the downsides are, to be honest with you. Maybe Brent has some other thoughts.
I think it's an interesting idea, one that we need to explore. And there are certainly, even now, many tools available for folks who are doing their own, who are trying to be their own first line of defense against this kind of fraud. The groups that really understand how important education is, groups like the Utah State Division of Securities, they have a very good website. You can actually search their database of offenders. The group that regulates stockbrokers, it's called FINRA, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. They also have a great website that will allow you to search registered professionals, stockbrokers, investment advisors. So there are some tools out there, but obviously not enough.
Brent Baker, founder and director of the Fraud College. Brent, thanks for your time. Mark Zimbelman, accounting professor at BYU, and thanks to you as well. The next Fraud College will be held this Wednesday from 8 to noon at the University of Utah. More information is on our website, kcpw.org. City Views is a production of KCPW News. Next time, Chocolate 101. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.